On Demand. This is our AFR exclusive podcast. I'm your host, Jenna Ellis, and we do a deeper dive on this program from our radio side into some topics that maybe are a little more evergreen or news of the day we just didn't have time to cover in the only 1 hour that AFR gives me. I've been lobbying for a while for more than that. But today we wanted to talk about everything going on in the EU, the UK, and King Charles III meeting President Trump in the Oval Office, and he delivered an historic address to Congress in a state visit earlier this week. So this visit commemorates America's 250th anniversary, of course, of independence from the British Crown. So really interesting there. I saw some commentary where Trump actually called King Charles Charles, because that's his name. And some people, even Americans, were very offended by that. And I'm thinking, you know, again, we fought a war 250 years ago, and we don't have to recognize the king as the king because he's not our king. But then the White House also made some waves because they posted a picture of President Trump with King Charles with the caption, "Two kings with a crown." And of course, the left went wild, as they always do, which is just such fun trolling, to be honest. Like, those are the posts that I think historians years from now will look back and just say, you know, there was never quite an era like the Trump era. And during the evening, in addition to addressing Congress, King Charles met with House Speaker Mike Johnson, and also the King and Queen Camilla also participated in a state dinner with President Trump and First Lady Melania. And Trump had some kind of funny remarks, actually, and this is cut one.
This is a great honor, and we welcome Their Majesties King Charles III and Queen Camilla of the United Kingdom to the White House. Very special place, very, very special. And I also want to, before we really begin, I want to congratulate Charles on having made a fantastic speech today at Congress. He got the Democrats to stand. I've never been able to do that. I couldn't believe it. They liked him more than they've ever liked any Republican or Democrat, actually.
So, in just classic Trump fashion, it's great. President Trump also claimed that King Charles agrees that Iran should not have a nuclear weapon during that state banquet at the White House. He said, "We're doing a little Middle East work right now. We're doing very well." He said that was Tuesday night, referencing the Iran war as he delivered his speech. And this is coming from Time magazine. He said, "We have militarily defeated that particular opponent, and we're never going to let that opponent ever," and Charles agrees with me even more than I do, "we're never going to let that opponent have a nuclear weapon. They know that." So the remark risks, at least according to Time, drawing the king into a political row over the Iran war, the fallout which has already notably splintered relations between Washington and British Prime Minister Keir Starmer. The king is not a spokesperson for the British government, and as the UK head of state, he largely remains politically neutral, and Charles has made no direct mention of the Iran war during his own speech at the state banquet. But when approached for comment the next morning on Wednesday, a Buckingham Palace spokesperson said of Trump's remark, quote, "The king is naturally mindful of his government's longstanding and well-known position on the prevention of nuclear proliferation." So really interesting goings on in Washington this week with that state visit. So let's welcome in Larry Taunton, who is an author and freelance columnist. And Larry, your thoughts overall on, you know, this visit, especially as it comes as America is starting to celebrate our 250th.
Yeah, good to be with you, Jenna. I thought overall, and let me say this from the outset, I have generally been an Anglophile, and I certainly loved Queen Elizabeth II, a Republican that I am. That is in the sense of no monarchy. But Charles, I've not been a big fan of Charles. I don't consider him especially bright. He's a globalist. He's a one of the founding members of the WEF, the World Economic Forum. All of that said, I thought Charles took the high ground. His visit and his remarks, there was nothing Jimmy Kimmel-like in any of it. The jabs were, you know, were all good-natured in referring to, you know, King George and his reference to the fact that we might be speaking French, you know, if it weren't for the if it weren't for the English. I thought he took the high ground. I thought it was classy. I also thought it was in the spirit of the special relationship, and he referred to his mother, and as she often did, you know, very rightly, referring to our shared heritage, and you know, that is English common law, and a Christian faith, which he referred to. However, Jenna, that said, it doesn't alter the fact that from the perspective of government, we have very little in common anymore. I mean, Charles, as I said, is a globalist. He has been, in spite of his reference to his nod to the Christian faith, he has absolutely bent the knee to Islamists, to jihadists. The last great breach between our nations, which he hinted at in speaking of his mother's 1957 visit to the United States, and she was here to repair the relationship, the special relationship between the United States and Britain as a result of the Suez Crisis, which is very similar to what's happening in Iran. But you see, that breach, Jenna, in 50, actually the Suez Crisis was 56, but she visited in 57. That breach was due to a disagreement in policy. But you see, now we're talking about a breach ideologically, and that's not been the case since 1776.
Mm-hmm. And you know, all of this is so fascinating. And of course, you know, Trump had met with Queen Elizabeth II several times. And like you, I held a great respect for the Queen. I thought she was very stately. You know, she did her job well. I don't hold King Charles and especially a Camilla in nearly as high of esteem, particularly because of the Muslimification, if we want to use that word, of particularly Britain, and the overall, really, it seems like the open embrace by Charles and also William, who will be the next king, of Muslims in the nation. And so I think you're right that the ideology has really shifted with King Charles's reign. And it's interesting to see how Britain views the United States. I mean, I'm invited all the time, oddly, I think, on LBC Radio, of course, a London radio, and they're so fascinated with everything that goes on in the United States. You know, that relationship, and of course, the liberals and, you know, the leftist globalists that run that radio station tend to disfavor Trump, is probably too mild of a word. But, you know, but they see the relationship largely as necessary and as longstanding allies between the UK and the United States. And so how should we interpret overall this meeting and Charles' message to Congress in terms of moving forward with the relationship with the UK, especially when Charles emphasized NATO and Ukraine, which I kind of took as a subtle rebuke of the kind of America First agenda?
Yeah, there were some subtle, you know, jabs in there. You saw Chuck Schumer and Democrats, you know, leap to their feet and applaud wildly when he was talking about the Magna Carta and checks on executive power. And, you know, so they, you know, they love that because they love to imply, of course, that Trump is a king. But here's the dynamic that's going on that's in the background. As I say, things have changed ideologically, fundamentally ideologically, between the United States and Britain. And that didn't used to be the case. The differences were over policy. They weren't over, you know, an actual worldview. But now we're talking about a fundamental difference in worldview. And J.D. Vance, after the inauguration, you will recall, was was speaking at the security, I forget what they call it, but the, you know, kind of the annual Security Council meeting, and he said that we're not really sure that Britain is our ally anymore. I mean, because you guys don't believe in free speech. I mean, you're arresting people for memes. You're imprisoning a woman for prayer, possibly, you know, outside of an abortion clinic. If you recall, when she was asked if she was praying, she said, "I might be." You know, she was just standing there, wasn't bothering anybody, and this woman was arrested, made a lot of news. And now you have this school teacher who was arrested and has been in prison for 2 years because he refused to use, on the basis of his Christian faith, the preferred pronouns of a student. So this is where Britain is anymore. And then when you're talking about Islam, I think the last 2 times I've done interviews with you, Jenna, I think just by coincidence, the last time I believe I was in Paris just a couple of months ago, and I was in Paris to go to the no-go zones, or I may have been at the World Economic Forum, and the time before that, I was speaking to you from Rome. And so I am in Europe a lot. I was in Europe for almost 2 months already this year before going to Gaza and then back to Europe, you know, again. And what has happened in Europe, I was educated there in part in the early 90s, and it has changed massively. Britain used to be, you know, British, and now it's only vaguely British. London itself is Londonistan, you know, now. So Britain's overall Muslim population is about 17%. France, it's 18%. Germany, it's a whopping 24%. There are roughly 46 million Muslims in Europe. So you can understand that given their open borders policy, their mass importation, and it has been an importation, isn't just opening the borders. I mean, it's deliberately bringing them in, just as was being done here in the United States by the Biden administration, that because of this red-green alliance, they are nervous to say much of anything against Islam anymore. I mean, Oxford University, I will be at Oxford next month for a debate, and guess the topic? The topic is Islam. Mm. And when you're talking about the head of the Oxford Union, a very prestigious debate organization, I believe he's a Muslim. You know what I mean? So many of the colleges at Oxford University now are funded by Saudi, Qatari, which is to say Muslim money. So all this money is flowing into Europe. They have discovered that they can buy universities, they can buy media influence, they can buy politicians, and they've absolutely done it. So that is the fundamental rift between our country in their country. And Charles is obviously a guy who has decided, I mean, for instance, take his remarks about encouraging interfaith dialogue. Muslims don't believe in that. Mm-hmm. They don't believe in that. There's nothing in the Quran, there's nothing in the Hadith, there's nothing in the life of Muhammad that suggests they're about interfaith dialogue. And I should also add, the Christian faith isn't about that either. So there is fundamental differences between the two. So either Charles is deeply naive and self-deceived, or he's evil.
Mm. Yeah, and you know, it is really fascinating to see the evolution, I guess, and the slow just decline of the UK to Muslims. And they've had, you know, a Muslim mayor of London, and maybe almost comparable to Mamdani in New York City. They've had, you know, an increase of the Muslim population, as you've said, and yet I think it's interesting when you look at how Charles mentioned, as you said, you know, the Magna Carta, our shared history, and the common law of England. I mean, all of this includes religious freedom, but it comes specifically from the Christian worldview. I mean, it comes specifically from understanding that there is objective moral truth, there is a divine lawgiver, and it specifically rejects the Muslim premise. I mean, this isn't an interfaith sort of dialogue, as you rightly point out. This isn't the coexist sort of bumper sticker. And so what does this say to you overall about where the United Kingdom is heading, and hopefully the United States is not heading in that same direction? There are a lot of Christian conservatives that are very concerned in this country about the rise of Sharia law and, you know, and some of those issues, and rightly so. And if we are still steady as at least hopefully having our constitution as the law of the land, not any other parallel legal system, where does this go then for the relationship with the United Kingdom, not necessarily just with Charles as the head of state, but with Keir Starmer and the British Parliament?
Well, I'm going to say something here that, Jenna, this is my own argument, and it's one that I hope will get momentum, and you'll either think I'm insane or you will agree with me. Let's start with my own senator, state of Alabama, Tommy Tuberville, who I appreciate very much for his strong stand on Islam. He is going after Sharia. He is saying we need to ban Sharia. My own argument says that's not the path to victory. The path to victory is to ban Islam. Now, you're a lawyer. And my son is a Yale-educated lawyer, and he argues with me about this all the time. He says, Dad, you can't do that because the Bill of Rights protects Islam as religious freedom. My argument is, no, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't because Islam is an ideology, not really a religion, but okay, we'll just say it is. But Islam is an ideology that is fundamentally at odds with everything in the Bill of Rights, meaning that when Islam is practiced in an orthodox fashion, not quote-unquote radicals, but when you're talking about real Muslims who do what the Quran, the Hadith, and the life of Muhammad, which they are all supposed to model themselves after, it is fundamentally at odds with everything in the Bill of Rights. Mm-hmm. So Islam does not believe in freedom of religion, assembly, press, petition, speech, doesn't believe in any of that, does not believe in equality between men and women, does not believe in equality between Arabs and black people. Islam is fundamentally racist. Islam is a religion of violence. Islam is a religion of child marriage. Islam is a religion of rape. Islam is a religion of violence and pillaging. So my argument is that we have to go after Islam, deny it the protection of religion, because, you see, people afforded in the United States who are naive a certain level of respect because, well, it's religion. But you see, it's a religion of hate. And until we begin to realize that it is just as at odds with, more so, at odds with our Constitution and with our values, as is, say, fascism or Marxism, we're never really going to be able to grapple with this, because you're talking about bringing people into this country who don't share our values. And I really want to stress this, Jenna, because there is an effort to divide people on the right by race, by sex, separate out, you know, Jewish people and say that they're evil. There's a rising, you know, anti-Semitism. These are all psyops. Authentic conservatism recognizes that this is not about race. It's not about ethnicity. It is about ideology. I don't care what your color is. I don't care who your tribe or your clan are. If you can say, we hold these truths to be self-evident, you're my brother, you're my countryman. But if you cannot, you need to get out, and we do not need to allow such people into our country.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And, you know, with all due respect to your son and his legal education, I was educated the same way in law, right? I mean, this is what most law schools across the country, unless you come from an actual truthful worldview, they have adopted this view of law that is grounded in secular pluralism and the idea that we can and must coexist peacefully within the same society and share power with various viewpoints rather than enforcing a single uniform standard, which has always been American law and the U.S. Constitution. And so I think we are wrongly categorizing Islam and especially Sharia law as a religion that is afforded certain protections under the Constitution rather than rightly characterizing it as a parallel legal system that is in competition and conflict with our Constitution and our laws that are made in accordance with the U.S. Constitution. I mean, just like we don't have, any other parallel legal system like the British Parliament. We don't observe their same law. We don't have a monarchy in this country. That is the British way of doing things because we are Americans. And so when we have and we arrive to the conversation with this idea that America was founded on secular pluralism and that we allow various viewpoints to be enforced in our law instead of enforcing a single uniform standard, that's where we get off. Now, obviously, the First Amendment protects the right to believe. I mean, people can believe all kinds of crazy things. You can believe the earth is flat and the government isn't going to prosecute you for it, right? But if you were trying to enact a law in furtherance of a viewpoint that is expressly against our highest law of the land, that's where it becomes in conflict and unconstitutional, and where this isn't a matter of religious belief or freedom of expression or any of the things that the First Amendment protects. It ultimately becomes a matter of enforcing American law and jurisprudence. And this is where, you know, I literally wrote an entire book on this. It's called The Legal Basis for a Moral Constitution, and how we have to in 2026 now, even though I wrote the book in 2015, we have to get back to an understanding of where our law and our Constitution is grounded in. And we're celebrating that this year, which is the Declaration of Independence. And that worldview statement that says we hold truth to be self-evident. Truth is objective. Our rights come from God, our creator, not our government. And this is what our nation was founded on. And then the Constitution was ratified pursuant to that mandate. And if anything comes into conflict with that, then by definition, it is not only un-American, but it is unconstitutional. So we aren't a secular pluralist nation. We don't have to coexist with Muslims. We don't have to coexist with Sharia law. We don't have to coexist with any of these other belief systems and ideologies that are fundamentally in conflict. And I think, Larry, that we have taken advantage and honestly perverted the ability to amend our Constitution that our founders provided so we could tweak and tailor a more perfect union according to the Declaration's mandate. And we've used and abused that in order to foment a secular pluralist society in ways that our founders never intended. So this is a great example of how we need to get back to the main thing, which is our Declaration statement that is still binding on American jurisprudence, American law, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial across not only the federal government, but also the states. And so when we contrast that with how Britain and the UK and all of the, you know, the globalist ideology that is proliferating in their society, they don't have the same protections that we do, but we need to take advantage of our protections.
Yes, I completely agree with you. And to be fair to my son, we will debate these things over cigars, and he is a hardcore conservative, but he's looking at it, you know, from his understanding of the law.
And how
I'm looking
he was taught.
At it not just from the perspective of law. And by law, I don't just mean American jurisprudence, but the law you're referring to, you know, God's law, our country was founded on the idea that there are laws that are higher than man's law. So the Declaration of Independence wasn't appealing to British law. It was appealing to God.
Mm-hmm.
And it was saying that just as the abolitionists would do later, that, you know, whatever the law states, God's law says that these laws are damnable and we will not abide by them. And but I'm also looking at this from a very practical perspective. I mentioned that I was just, you know, I was just in Israel. I was in Gaza. I was in, you know, in Cairo last year, where the Muslim Brotherhood tried to do me in, and that made some pretty big headlines. I just had here with me, if you, many people in your audience, I'm sure, are very aware of the persecution taking place in Nigeria. I was there doing a series for Fox on that, and we just had the Nigerian bishop, Anglican bishop, here with us. He's been with us many times, but we brought him here again, and it's in his diocese where these things are happening. And it's fun for me to watch him interact with woke people in this country, because first of all, Africans, there's nothing PC about them. They're not in the least bit politically correct, and so they tend to be fairly blunt. But he's coming from the perspective of people in his diocese who've been murdered, mutilated, children taken off into sex slavery, wives raped, a boy's macheted. And when he's talking to an audience of, you know, let's say white liberals, or in some case, black liberals, he just cuts right through the nonsense and says, you know, the religion you're talking about, that is to say Islam, bears no reality with what Islam actually is. And he talks about Islam, and he talks about how it's, you know, it's slowly has, you know, taken root in his own country, and what's happening there and the way that they work. I've been there. I've seen it. I've seen the persecution. I've heard the stories. I've seen it in other parts of the Middle East. Just as I say, you know, Gaza, what Hamas has done there, very little of what is being reported to you about what Hamas has done actually gets at the real issue. And I don't think that that's necessarily some plot by media to prevent you from knowing the truth. I do think that there is a plot to prevent you from knowing the truth of what happened there. But I think that our media is so secular that it doesn't understand religious motivations. And so it sees this all from a political point of view, when the reality is what is driving Hamas, what drove Yahya Sinwar, the planner of the October 7th attacks, was his devotion to Islam. The planned rape of Israeli women, the planned mutilation of Israeli men, women, and children, the beheading of babies, all these kinds of things were driven by an evil ideology known as Islam. And we're very, very foolish if we think that we can ride that tiger and we can bring it into the United States and somehow civilize it. You cannot. You just simply cannot.
So well said. And, you know, this is the danger of Islam. And I did an hour-long program with a former Muslim who became a Christian, Shahram Hadian, and who's actually originally from Iran. For listeners who want to go back into our AFR.net archive, listen to that program. You can just search for that with Shahram Hadian, and talking about, you know, the truth of what Islam actually teaches, and how, no, we do not serve the same God. And even though Islam acknowledges Jesus as a prophet, I mean, that's not acknowledging his lordship and his divinity. And as you mentioned, Larry, it's a completely different, not only legal system, but ideology, worldview, and a completely different, at the end of the day, worldview. And so, you know, as we move forward then into, you know, beyond 2026, and we see how the UK has gone way off of their original trajectory, of course, with their history, which is much longer, of course, than the United States, but how we have also drifted into secular pluralism, even though we still have the U.S. Constitution that's grounded in Christian law and tradition. How big of a gap do you think that this is creating? And at the end of the day, what concrete outcomes should we look for when we're looking at the longevity of whether or not we really stay close allies, the United States with Britain? Because we have, you know, a base that is suggesting that even longstanding allies like Israel aren't necessarily always allies. And I think that that kind of viewpoint is spilling over a little bit into other long-term allies, and people are beginning to question, you know, where we go from here, especially, I think rightly so, I'm against the whole, you know, anti-Semitic, anti-Israel movement, but they are, I think, rightly questioning our participation in NATO, our participation in some of these other more globalist agencies that then think that they can dictate to the United States our foreign policy. So with this visit kind of in context with King Charles, where does the United States go from here?
Great question, Jenna. Well, a couple of things. When you're talking about the divergence, you know, the United States in one direction and Britain in the other, you know, what is this ideological gap, you know, being caused by? Well, it's the erosion of the Christian faith in both mm-hmm. countries, but particularly in Britain. Most people don't realize that the peak of church attendance in Britain wasn't, as most would think, say, during the you know, let's say the Reformation or the Great Awakenings. It actually was on the heels of the Billy Graham Crusades in the late 1950s. Hmm. So fairly recent history was the peak of British church attendance, and yet the erosion of that faith in that country has been startling. I mean, let's think about it. This is the country of Cranmer, of Whitfield, of John Wesley. This is the country of Spurgeon. This is the country that gave us some of the really great Christian lights, you know, Wilberforce, Queen Victoria, and I would argue Queen Elizabeth II, and on, some of the greatest giants of the Christian faith were British. Mm. And look at what this country has now become. And I think Britain has caved to Islam as in direct proportion to the decline of the Christian faith. And they have become a generally, you know, kind of a soulless sort of people. And they see themselves, many of them, I'm speaking in generalities here, and that's why I make a distinction between the people and the government. The government, in many ways, Keir Starmer's government, doesn't reflect the will of most British people. But that said, Britain, it cannot be said to be a Christian nation now or a decade ago or 30 years ago. It's still running off of the accumulated capital of the Christian faith, but long since, you know, chopped the legs off of that and is now aggressively attacking the Christian faith. I think that when Britain is now talking about the special relationship, it does so in a very manipulative kind of way. I think Britain feels, again, when we're talking about their government, when we're talking about Charles, it feels rather condescending towards the United States, condescending towards, you know, red states, condescending in the sense of that we are, you know, kind of a bunch of rednecks and this sort of thing. However, they need our money. They want our money. They want the United States to fund all of their projects, whether it's a war against a proxy war against Russia in Ukraine, or it is you know, funding NATO, because they can't fund it because these are have become soft, you know, socialist semi-democracies that don't have the money for that, and their militaries are quite small, so they want the United States there paying the bill for all of these things, but they don't want our opinion. And what Trump has done is Trump has said, no. If you're taking our money, you are absolutely getting our opinions, and in some cases you'll do what we tell you to do, and we're just simply not going to fund it. I mean, I'm a child of the military. My brother was born in Germany, and that's because my father was stationed there, the 101st Airborne. He was stationed there when the Berlin Wall went up. He was stationed there during the Kennedy assassination, some of those tense moments of the Cold War. And he was there in the event of a Russian attack on Europe. The point I'm simply making is that American boys have been defending Europe since World War II. The Marshall Plan is the most generous post-war settlement in the history of mankind. What an extraordinary humanitarian achievement. And that was done on the backs of the American people who had generated the most powerful economy in the world and can rebuild an entire continent, to say nothing of the rebuilding of Japan. So that's where we find ourselves. We find ourselves in a place where we're dealing with people with whom we have very little in common anymore, ideologically speaking, but they just want our money. And by the way, having been in both Russia and Ukraine many times, my first book was about child trafficking in Ukraine well before this particular war. Ukraine and Russia are both, they're mirror images of each other, and that's because their history is shared going all the way back to, you know, the founding of Kyiv in the 9th century. The first Russian state was founded in what is modern-day Ukraine, so hence the reason the Russians consider Ukraine to be a part of Russia, whatever it is that the Ukrainians believe. But they are both mirror images of each other insofar as they are both deeply corrupt. And the United States has no business being involved in that war. That is not America first in the way that I think that Iran is America first. Venezuela is America's, or America first. And I hope, because Rubio's hinted at it, that Cuba is America first.
Yeah, and it's such a fascinating redrawing of the risk board, you know, for good analogy, right? Because as we head, you know, further away from what was, you know, the allies of World War II and kind of how things have been set up in recent and then into modern American history, we're seeing a divergence really based more in ideology than foreign policy. And I find that really fascinating because often, you know, a lot of the need for allies, you know, came from a need for help in wars and conquests and all of that throughout history. But to see President Trump taking a stand for American values and for our ideology and for the founding of this country, I think it's incredible, and it's a blessing that he is president instead of a Democrat communist for America's 250, because I think we're celebrating this in a very different way than we would otherwise. But to see that he is reinforcing those values, I mean, you know, whatever else listeners may disagree with him on, these are really good characteristics to stand firm and say, you know, the United States is not going to become like these other European nations, and we are not going to cede to Islam. We are not going to cede our values in a variety of other fashions that you just talked about, Larry. And so, you know, the question then, and, you know, as we're almost drawing to an end of our time here, and I so appreciate your deep dive commentary, where does this go in 2028? Because really in 2024, I saw this not as a personality contest, but really a clash of worldview. And after the primary, especially, what I told my listeners is, listen, don't think that you're voting for Donald Trump or Kamala Harris. I mean, you know, obviously those are the names on the ballot. But what you're voting for is a fundamental difference in worldview, in ideology, in civil government, in values, in freedom, in literally every single aspect that touches and concerns American life and also our foreign policy, a complete difference. And I think we're going to see that contrast as well in 2028.
Yeah, I think so too, Jenna. I would urge everyone out there to in many ways, I would say just get off social media. Shut off a lot of the news. Keep listening to me and to Jenna Ellis. And but otherwise, don't fall for the psyops that are out there. And there are a lot of them. And by the way, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm just simply saying there are efforts to divide and to convince people. I mean, what we're seeing with Tucker Carlson, for example, I haven't even discussed that with you, Jenna, so I don't know your opinion.
But, it's ridiculous. Candace Owens, he's gone off the deep end completely.
The direction that we see Megyn Kelly going and various others, just tune all that stuff out, because the fact of the matter is that conservatives must unite, both for the midterms and for the presidential election in 2028, because we're talking about fighting for the soul of America. That's what we're talking about. And if Democrats win, America as we know it is over. America as we know it is over. But I also want to say our hope is not in any man. Mm-hmm. Our hope is not in our government, all of which we know are flawed. We know that the best of us, Jeremiah 17:9, the heart is deceitful and desperately wicked above all things. Who can know it? So we know that. Our hope and what sets us apart from the rest of the world, traditionally speaking, is that our hope has been in God, specifically the God of the Bible, Jesus Christ. That is where our hope is. And so that's where we have to turn. So as people prepare the coming elections, by all means, engage with your neighbors at the, you know, over the backyard fence, or your colleagues at the water cooler at the lunch table, or some soiree where you're at, but also be on your knees in prayer for this country, because we very much need it.
So well said, and what a great admonition, because I think as we talk about politics, we talk about policy, we can sometimes be so wrapped up in the politics and policy and civil government, we don't think about taking that step back, and that's why it is important to listen to radio networks like American Family Radio, because we do that intentionally, purposefully, take that step back and say, okay, well, we need to look at these things through the biblical worldview lens and realize that solutions, you know, yes, engage in policy and voting in, you know, all of the ways that we are called to as Christians and just good citizens, but recognize ultimately this is a spiritual battle. Recognize ultimately that the solution to the problem of sin and evil is the redemptive work of Christ, and that as bad as things may get, or whoever is president in 2028, or however the midterms go and all of that, Christ is still on the throne, and he knows the trajectory of history because it literally is his story. And it doesn't mean then that we just sit back and say, okay, well, then our participation doesn't matter. But it means that ultimately we have hope for eternity, and that our focus isn't just on these temporal things for themselves and their own sake, but in order to ultimately promote the truth of the gospel and bring more people into a saving knowledge of that redemptive plan. So, Larry, I so appreciate your commentary, and it's always so great to speak with you. And where can people find you and your work?
Yes, they can find me, Jenna, on X, Twitter, as I still call it, at Larry Taunton. That's T-A-U-N-T-O-N. And they can find me at LarryAlexTaunton.com.
Amazing. Well, follow Larry and his great work, and share this episode on demand with a friend who maybe is confused about these things, you know, needs to understand why Islam is not just a religion, but it's a parallel legal system that is in conflict with their U.S. Constitution, you know, wants to make sense of some of these headlines. And you can always find prior episodes, of course, at AFR.net. And I will join you again next week here on Demand.